Life is all about the choices that you make, and so is this episode. If the last episode was all about expectations, this one is going to be about decisions, and how making the right one or the wrong one can literally be the difference between having a job and not. So, in light of that, let's do a little thought experiment. Okay, here we go. You're the GM of an NFL team, and you've got a very important decision to make. You've got a team that a lot of people think are Super Bowl contenders, but they're missing one very important piece. Now, if you know where we're going with this, try not to spoil it for everyone else. Remember, this is for science. Okay, so you've got a big hole at quarterback, and you've got to choose between two options. And let me just go ahead and say, neither one is going to sound great. Okay, we'll start with number one. The good here is very good. He's a former first-round pick that definitely passes the eye test. He's 28, which is right around the time he should be in his prime, and especially if you're trying to win now, that's perfect. He's also a three-time Pro Bowler, and led the league in passing yards two seasons ago. He's widely regarded as one of the most talented quarterbacks in the league, but he damaged his ACL, MCL, and PCL early on in the previous year, and missed almost the entire season. And while he's never exactly been an elite dual-threat guy, he used to be very mobile, and presumably that injury is going to significantly impact that part of his game. So you have to measure who he is at his best against who he might be when you actually get him into camp. It's not perfect, but it's a decent option. Now on to number two, which is a little bit more of a wild card. Number two had a breakout season 2 years ago and made his first Pro Bowl. He's 2 years younger than QB1, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in NFL quarterback years, that's like 30. But the downside here is pretty down. He's coming off a horrible injury that his doctors told him later was 1 in 500. And even before he got injured, the GM from his previous team, for whatever reason, pretty obviously didn't believe in him as the long-term option. So what do you do? Neither one is exactly what you want, but your team needs a quarterback, and you have no choice but to choose one. And whichever one you do end up choosing will fundamentally change the narrative for your team, and not even just for this upcoming season, for the next 12 years. No pressure. I'm Will Shingleton, and in this episode of 2000 and Saban, you'll find out who both of these guys are, and how they paved the way for Nick Saban to take over college football. Figure out why people make decisions, and then understanding their consequences after the fact, can be tricky. And throughout the Nick Saban to Alabama story, a lot of tough decisions were made. It's a complicated issue to try and address, but we're going to do our best. And to do that, we're actually barely going to talk about Nick Saban at all. The title of our show is 2000 and Saban, and it's mostly about the Miami Dolphins and the University of Alabama, but today we're going to start in New York. In the spring of 2004. At the very beginning of the 2004 NFL draft, the San Diego Chargers took Eli Manning from Ole Miss. This was a quarterback-rich draft, and the Chargers had gotten the guy who most people thought was the best of the bunch. The only problem with that was that Eli Manning wasn't going to play for the Chargers, not just because he was about to get traded, but also because he had said he would sit out the entire season if they picked him. The rumor was that the Manning camp didn't want Eli to wind up with a career like his dad, who had languished on some pretty horrible Saints teams for the entire time he was in the NFL. So the Chargers did about the only thing they could. In a first round that had a record 28 trades, they made the most important one. Eli Manning went to the New York Giants, and NC State's Phillip Rivers, who the Giants had selected at 4, wound up in San Diego. Now, most teams that pick quarterbacks at the top of the draft do so because they don't have a ton of confidence in the guys they already have. The interesting thing about that is that the Chargers already had a future Hall of Famer at quarterback. They just didn't know it. For the next 2 years, the Chargers quarterback room was less like an episode of Hard Knocks and more like an episode of Downton Abbey. And not like one of the middle seasons where people are dying and things are actually happening, but one of the early ones where we were still trying to figure out who was going to marry who and everyone had an opinion on who should end up where. And there were three suitors vying for the hand of the Chargers' starting job. The first was actually Doug Flutie, who we haven't even mentioned yet. Flutie was 42 at the time, so I can't decide if he had more in common with one of the men on the show or the Dowager Countess in this analogy. Anyway, he was actually the starter in Philip Rivers' first season. But the second guy on the depth chart wasn't Philip Rivers. It was the other future Hall of Famer. See, the Chargers had drafted Philip Rivers to replace Drew Brees. And that started the drama. Not quite a historical period drama, but close. Throughout this 2-year ordeal, a couple of things became pretty clear. First, Drew Brees was playing well, and Coach Marty Schottenheimer wanted to keep playing him. He backed his guy. And second, A.J. Smith had drafted Philip Rivers, and really wanted him to play. So after a certain amount of time, it became obvious that we were going to have ourselves a good, old-fashioned standoff. And all of this came to a tipping point at the end of the 2005 season. Just to ground that a little more, Nick Saban and the Dolphins are winning their 6th game in a row to end the season at that time. And Alabama is having their best season yet under Mike Shula. But Drew Brees is needlessly getting thrown into a meaningless game at the end of the season because his coach is stubbornly trying to prove a point. Just to show A.J. Smith who's really in charge here, he starts Drew Brees in Week 17 against the Broncos. So the coach and the general manager of the team are in a pretty petty standoff with their two blue-chip quarterbacks in the middle. And who ends up paying for it? Well, suffice it to say, neither of the guys who were making the decisions. During that game against the Broncos, as he's rolling out near his own end zone, Brees gets the ball stripped from behind. It rolls around near the goal line, and in an effort to prevent the Broncos from scoring a touchdown, Brees dives on the loose ball. But as he's doing that, a Broncos defensive lineman named Gerard Warren is doing the same thing, and he lands right on top of Drew Brees' right shoulder, which, in case you were wondering, is his throwing shoulder. Kind of an important joint. And just in case you were curious, Gerard Warren weighs about 325 pounds. In layman's terms, Drew Brees essentially gets broken. He suffers a 360-degree tear of his labrum and a 50% tear of his rotator cuff, two vitally important structures in and around the shoulder, both heavily involved in throwing, and now both are heavily damaged. Drew Brees has played his last snap as a Charger, and his future as a quarterback in the NFL is in serious jeopardy. Now, if you've read ahead a little bit here, you know that things are going to turn out okay for Drew Brees. He eventually lands on his feet, and thankfully, nobody else lands on his feet. But the next few months after this incident are going to be incredibly tough for him. He's got an injury to the most valuable joint on his body that's incredibly difficult to rehab from. And the worst part of it all is that it was almost entirely avoidable. He had no business even being on the field in that Week 17 game. And because two grown-ass men were more worried about getting their way than getting their players out of harm's way, this poor guy's entire livelihood is up in the air. And in an episode about decisions, that may be the worst one we'll talk about. But despite his arm pretty much being separated from the rest of his body, Brees had still caught the eye of a couple of the league's most quarterback-hungry teams. One of which was coached by a guy whose name, spelled backwards, is Nabaskin. And while you're trying to unravel that little puzzle, we'll take a short break. After the 2005 season, the Dolphins were feeling pretty good about themselves. They had started out 3-7, but won 6 games in a row to finish out the season over 500 for the first time in a couple of years. At the end of Nick Saban's first year with the team, there was really a sense that they had turned a corner and that the players had started to buy into his system. And with most of the team returning for the next season, they were getting a lot of preseason playoff love from the media. A lot of people even had them pegged to represent the AFC in the Super Bowl. They really only had one major hole, but it was at the most important position on the field. They had just missed the playoffs, with Gus Frerotte and Sage Rosenfels as the only two quarterbacks on the roster, so there was a sense that if they could only upgrade there, they would be a legitimate threat in the AFC playoff race. And if you'll recall, there was at least one very available quarterback on the market. But buying into this idea meant that they had fallen into one of the classic NFL traps, the idea of being just a quarterback away. The irony of that idea, of course, is that it's almost never a thing. There are exceptions to that, but in reality, almost no one is ever really just a quarterback away. Even if a team is seemingly complete outside of the guy under center, that's way too simple of a solution for such a complicated problem. Here's what I mean. In August 2016, Vikings quarterback Teddy Bridgewater went down with a horrible injury in practice, tearing his ACL and dislocating his knee. He'd made it to the Pro Bowl the year before, but now the Vikings would be without him for that whole season, and the next season. They were in a pretty tough spot, but they had a plan. They traded a first-round pick and a fourth-round pick to the Eagles for Sam Bradford. And Bradford had a very good year for the Vikings in 2016, posting the second-best QBR of his entire career. But Bradford, who had had two different ACL injuries previously in his career, injured his knee again 2 games into the 2017 season and was out for the year, which left the Vikings in even more of a lurch. With no Teddy Bridgewater, who was Plan A, and no Sam Bradford, who was Plan B, the Vikings now turned to journeyman backup Case Keenum, who up until that point had only made 24 career starts and had a QBR in the 40s. But the crazy thing about it was, it worked. Even playing with their third-choice quarterback, the Vikings had an insane season. They went 13-3, won their division, and made it all the way to the NFC Championship game against the Eagles. But of course, they don't give out trophies for just getting to the conference championship. And when they got there, it was clear that the Eagles had a massive advantage under center. Keenum threw 2 costly interceptions during the game, while his counterpart, Nick Foles, was nearly perfect, and the Vikings lost 38-7. They had come all that way, just to have their most glaring weakness exposed in the most public way possible. So at the end of that season, the Vikings had a decision to make. See, I told you that was going to be a theme. They had an incredible defense, great skill position players, but they still had a huge question mark at quarterback. Through very little fault of their own, they had become a cliche, a team that, just like the 2005 Dolphins, was just a quarterback away. Let's see how that turned out. They could choose door number 1, which meant officially handing the keys to Case Keenum, who had given them a season of incredible performances and an NFC title game appearance. But he was a career backup who had shown a lot of vulnerability when it mattered most, and statistically, he was more likely to regress to the mean than keep going on his insane pace from 2017. They could also choose door number 2, which was explore their options in the trade or free agency market. The biggest fish in free agency was former Redskins quarterback Kirk Cousins, who, improbably, had become one of the most prolific quarterbacks in the entire league during his time in Washington. He had fought for his job since 2015, and despite throwing for 4,000 yards in 3 straight years, the Redskins still didn't want to commit to him as their guy long term. He was actually the first quarterback to ever be franchise tagged twice, and was almost tagged a third time. But he made it to free agency after 2017, and listed the Vikings as one of his potential landing spots. And that seemed like a natural fit. Although bringing in Cousins was going to be outrageously expensive, the Vikings needed a quarterback to really commit to, and Kirk Cousins wanted to play for a team that really wanted him to play for them. And so, on March 5th, 2018, the Vikings agreed to a deal that would pay Kirk Cousins $84 million guaranteed dollars over 3 years, the most expensive guaranteed contract in NFL history. It had cost them an arm and a leg, but the Vikings had their man. So everything went great, right? They had filled their biggest hole, and so they went undefeated and won the title without even breaking a sweat, right? No, of course not. They struggled running the ball, and while their defense was still pretty formidable, they stumbled to 8-7-1 and missed the playoffs. So what's the moral of that story? It may seem like a team is just a piece away, especially if that piece is a quarterback, but that's not how that works. A team is almost never just a quarterback away. Football is way too complicated and random to be boiled down to that simple of a solution. But the paradoxical nature of that idea is that even though teams are rarely just a quarterback away from being a title-winning team, choosing who leads your team is still an incredibly important decision. Teams face a delicate balancing act between placing too much emphasis on that one position and not taking it seriously enough. As a counterexample, I give you the 2016 Houston Texans. In another case of a team with a great defense and great skill position players, it seemed like they could do no wrong with who they put under center. So when they threw $72 million at Brock Osweiler, who had started all of 7 games in his career at that point, most people still figured they would be fine. But 16 interceptions and an embarrassing playoff performance against the Patriots later, people had cooled off a lot on the Brock Lobster. Just as an aside, if your nickname gets you closer to the Hall of Fame than your play on the field, you might be in some trouble. But I digress. All of this talk about quarterbacks and decisions brings us back to the Dolphins gearing up for the 2006 season. Gus Frerotte had done fine the year before, but he was about to turn 35. And it's safe to say that they needed a better long-term option. Saban and his staff were deep in the weeds of trying to decide who they wanted under center for the next year, or the few years after that, for that matter. And realistically, with the cap space they had left and the market that was available, they basically had two options. The two options from the very beginning of this episode. Quarterback number one is a guy named Dante Culpepper, who was a multi-time Pro Bowler that had an excellent NFL resume. But as I mentioned earlier, he was coming off a pretty major knee injury that was in all likelihood going to affect his mobility. And quarterback number two, as you might have guessed, was the man with the mutilated labrum, Drew Brees. So which seriously injured quarterback did the Dolphins choose? Well, despite Saban's wishes, the Dolphins training staff recommended Culpepper. They figured that coming back from a knee ligament tear was easier than rebuilding an entire shoulder joint, and you can hardly blame them for that. But Culpepper ends up with the Dolphins, and Drew Brees goes to New Orleans, and the rest is history. And that history makes it very clear that Drew Brees is going to be an easy first ballot Hall of Famer, and Dante Culpepper is not. We'll get a lot deeper into Culpepper's time with the Dolphins next episode, but for now, we'll end with a tantalizing hypothetical. In the years since Drew Brees didn't end up with the Dolphins, fans have spent a lot of time speculating about what might have been. What if Drew Brees, in my opinion one of the 10 best quarterbacks to ever play, had teamed up with Nick Saban, arguably the greatest college football coach of all time? In the story of what actually happened, Drew Brees goes to the Saints, teams up with Coach Sean Payton, immediately helps turn them into a playoff contender, helps heal all of the collective hurt brought on by Hurricane Katrina the year before, and 3 years later, they've got their first Super Bowl. But what if he had been the missing piece in Miami instead? It may be tough to say that a team is just a quarterback away, but if that quarterback is Drew Brees, I don't know. Maybe they are. Sadly, we'll never know what would have happened if Drew Brees had found himself in South Beach, but it's still fun to talk about. Here's what our resident Dolphins fan Chris Jesse said when I asked him about it.
If Nick Saban gets Drew Brees after the 9-7 season instead of Dante Culpepper, what happens?
It's a loaded question. I mean, kind of like you said, I don't like to play the what if, but we all know that Drew Brees is one of the best quarterbacks in the league and has been for a very long period of time. And I do think that the Dolphins would have been closer to what they were under Marino than what they are now. But it's hard to say who would they have surrounded him with. What would the defenses be like? Because that one addition could change the entire outlook of the team as far as, you know, salary cap and really everything. So who can you afford to bring with them? I thought, not that Drew Brees is not an amazing quarterback, but I also feel like he's been blessed with the perfect system where he was. And we don't know if Brees would have fit Miami's system.
Yeah.
We just don't know.
Damn it, Chris, stop being so reasonable. But he's right. We don't know what would have happened. And it doesn't really do anyone any good to speculate. What we do know is that the Dolphins end up with Culpepper. And if they were just a quarterback away from being a Super Bowl team, he probably wasn't it. Decisions make and break franchises. That decision by the Chargers to draft a quarterback in 2004 trickled all the way down to Drew Brees being played in the 2005 season finale, and then put the Dolphins on the spot as to whether they would take a chance on him or not. And that decision from ownership and the medical staff to deny Saban the guy he wanted is going to cause problems. And if the exit door had been totally closed before, losing Drew Brees was going to open it up just a little bit. I'm Will Shingleton, and that'll be next time on 2007. Is a Free Time Media production. If you'd like to learn more about our shows, please visit our website at www.freetimemedia.co. If you like what you heard, please leave us a rating. And if you really like what you heard, leave us a review too. For more updates about 2007, please visit our Facebook page. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next installment, Pants on Fire.